This week on RSBNB Update, it's PVM time with Raksha. We run through everything you need to know about Raksha, the Shadow Colossus, from setups and mechanics all the way to lore. Then we have a discussion about Shadow Anima and what other Colossi may exist. This is RSBNB Update, episode 807, recorded Thursday, December 10th, 2020. Rocking out with Raksha. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. This week is an update that made me very, very uncomfortable because it is PVM related. But, you know, as things go with that, when you're uncomfortable with something, sometimes the best thing to do is face them head on. But if we did that and we provided that kind of coverage on the podcast this week, you know, Tanis and I, we really wouldn't know what to say about this boss, would we?
No.
No.
I've been watching people a lot, you know, a lot smarter and quicker than I am when it comes to the boss this week, and I still can't make a whole lot of sense of it. So I'm glad David and...
You can introduce them. This is to discuss Raksha, the Shadow Colossus, of course, and joining us as per usual with any kind of PVM interest is David, our resident PVM expert. Welcome back. And we just heard you recently.
It's good to be back, yeah.
We just heard you recently on our PVM Death Cost monthly bit, which anybody who has access to, I would highly recommend giving that a listen. That was a really good, really good monthly bit. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And he didn't even whine.
He didn't. Oh. And we learned lots about the PVM economy.
Yeah.
And also because this boss is heavily entwined with lore, is quest caping. Guild Council member from Clan Quest, first time on the podcast. Welcome.
Hello, hello. Good to be here. And yes, quite excited about the lore going on here. And I've attempted the PVM side of it. Haven't actually got a kill in, but yeah.
Hey, good for you for trying, though. That's awesome. Mm.
I still want to try and manage one before the nerfs come in next week.
I wanted to try and have a look at it. I didn't, you know, actually kit myself out and, you know, attempt to move forward with it. But still, I went in to have a look at it. And that was about the end of the experiences on that. But anyways.
That was it for you, James.
What was that, Terrence? Yeah,
that was it for you?
Yeah, that was it
just
for
me. Just a little looky.
Yeah, just have a little look. But I do want to kill it because it actually looks pretty good.
How do you feel about deranged, roided out Barney, Shane?
You know, I have heard people call it Barney before.
It's a giant purple dinosaur. What else are we supposed to call it?
I've heard a good few nicknames. I've heard Chad's Jad.
Yeah, that's good, too. Oh, yeah.
That's a 2020 one.
Plenty
of chats.
You know, if you're joining us for the first time here at RSBNB Update, you can find full show notes and follow along at update.rsbnb.com. And, of course, if you want to join us in game, we're at Friends Chat, Bits Bytes, and we also have Patreon at patreon.com/RSBNB if you like the podcast that much and you want to support, but we'll talk more about that after. So here's how we're going to split this up. We're going to start off the boss and, of course, talking about the mini quest, because there was a little mini quest that you had to do in order to gain access to this boss. It's about a 5-minute mini quest, and, you know, this goes back to, you remember, Tanis, when we were doing that round table on Anachronia, and we predicted archaeology, that grate that was all broken and busted. Well, it turns out that this is exactly the area where you wind up fighting Raksha inside of there. So that was kind of fun to see that we had to go back there.
Yeah, the exact spot that we said there could be a solo boss coming, and then everything would be like the next thing would be added to Anachronia, and we're like, huh. And then something else would be added to Anachronia, and we're like, huh. And finally they show off Raksha.
Yeah, and finally we're here.
Delayed gratification, but we got there in the end.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, the mini quest, the whole purpose of the mini quest is you talk with Lana Kea, and she wants to figure out what's inside of this area. And you as the World Guardian, have to go in there and siphon away the Shadow Anima, because as we know, for everybody else in this world, Shadow Anima is dangerous, except for us, because we have that tiny little bit of Shadow Anima protection that was put inside of us at the end of the World Wakes, part of Guthix's gift that he gave us. And we siphon away the Shadow Anima, and then you can go and unlock this door that is glowing purple after you talk with Lana Kea. And now the interesting part about this is that when you open this door, you have to tell Lana Kea that, you know, you have to go back. You can't be here with me because this is a dangerous area for you, and it's not gonna be good for your health and well-being, and it's going to kill you because Shadow Anima and you as the World Guardian know how to handle it. And, you know, you just mosey on in down there, walk down the bridge, and who do you find down there? Bam, you find Zaros. And he takes you.
He's always the one who's showing up.
Yeah. And, you know, he showed up in the Carapac track, too. So he has been around Anachronia, and the time frame that was given in this was a few months. So, you know, I don't think it's too surprising on this. But then you're presented with the graphic cutscene that we saw at the reveal from last week's live stream that we talked about. But maybe I'll just ask you guys this week, since both of you weren't here to discuss this, David and Questscaping, what do you guys think about the cutscene that we have here?
Yeah, so that's where we've got the reveal that, well, the monolith at the Archaeology Guild was in fact the Elder Codex. We've got that Elder artifact right in the middle of the Archaeology. And there's quite something up with it from the looks of things. For instance, we find out in this very cutscene that Raksha was a regular old Rex that stumbled on into it and popped out sometime later as the massive beast we see before us today. And powered by Shadow Anima, no less. And that's particularly interesting, isn't it? Because Elder Gods and Shadow Anima don't mix, and yet here we have something massively Shadow Anima powered popping out of an Elder artifact.
Yeah, and
so there's a lot to think about.
Yeah, and you know, I'm wondering if there was if there is anything with this that is directly related to the storyline that we're going to see, or if this is kind of a bit of an offshoot. I'm specifically talking about Raksha, because the sense I got from this, did you get the sense that Raksha, the dinosaur wandering into the Codex, was an accident and not intentional?
Yeah, and it's like, so Guildmaster Tony also, he's our previous example of someone being sucked into the Codex.
And we do have a question on that later.
Yeah. We do, yes.
So that one should be fun to discuss. And, you know, what I think we get from this at the end of the day, and I think there's two ways we go from this, is that the Dragonkin were ultimately studying Raksha after it went back to the island and they had managed to imprison it here. And your goal as the adventurer is to kill it, or subdue it at least, so that it's not going to, you know, break out, which I think is you know, fairly to be expected from all of this at the end of the day. But do you think that there was anything, and this is a question for all of you here, do you think there was anything malicious with Raksha? Do you think Zaros is trying to let it loose to have it do something as an example? Or do you think maybe Carapac wanted to let it loose? Because remember, when his device was shut down, that's what caused Raksha to start to become a problem. That's taken away when you talk to the Keeper.
I'm not sure if there's anything in particular along those lines. As far as Zaros goes, as we see in the mini quest, he basically runs off and leaves us to it.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, gives us free reign to do whatever we want with this monster. And us being the world guardian, we do actually occasionally have to guard the world sometimes. And yep, so we put the thing back to sleep, as is the boss fight. As for Kerepak, he worked with it historically. I'm not sure if he'd necessarily have anything further he'd like to do with it. But there is a thing that appeared in the Orthon lore books. Do you mind if I talk about this now?
Yeah. Do that, then we'll get into the boss itself.
Yeah. As far as Kerepak's study goes, there's something rather intriguing that's been left hanging from the Orthon lore books. He said something about having spent some time with Raksha and having had a symbol of a circle flanked by two triangles transmitted into his head, and he believes that's where Raksha got its powers from. So Kerepak...
Yeah, and where have we seen that symbol before, right?
It's not something I recognize, or not something that, as far as I'm aware, anyone really recognized. But for all we know, it may well be something that crops up again in future. So keep an eye out. Circle flanked by two triangles.
Amazing.
I'm no lore expert, but I've learned to blame everything that could be blamed on Kerepak. So.
Oh yeah, I think that's pretty safe.
That's what I'm going with. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Do we want to? Are there any other questions or things we want to mention about the Keeper? And you know, I would recommend that everybody, if you even don't intend on fighting the boss, go do this mini quest, talk to the Keeper. It'll get you up to date on everything that's happening Anachronia. Lore-wise, fun little tidbits here and there. Anything you guys want to point out before we move on to the boss itself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the Keeper, we find out, he is a dragonkin who's been left in there just as the living security system for Raksha. We can have a chat with him. We can talk about how he ended up there. And through that... anyone who's done the Orthon lore books gets a bit of dialogue that you can only unlock when you've unlocked those lore books, finding out that, in fact, this guy is Varanus, one of the Nodon Dragonkin, and the hunter who brought Raksha down and presumably got killed in the first place. And this is interesting because Orthendick site, the very first site, is supposedly Varanus' tomb.
Yep.
Everyone's just been toiling away in there.
Yep.
Leveling up their archaeology in the place where we thought this guy was dead.
Yep.
Turns out, nope.
And the Keeper also makes reference that, you know, as an archaeologist, you've discovered some tombs elsewhere on the island that look like they were broken out of it. And he says, yeah, this was me. So, I mean, there's confirmation of that right there, that was Varanus. And here is where Varanus went. So.
Mm-hmm. All thanks to Kerepak, of course. There's another... always Kerepak.
Yeah, and, you know, it just raises the question that there's so much more happening here below the surface than we initially knew. And I think it's really, really starting to form itself all well together. So, all right.
It's worth popping down and having a chat to him.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know... even if you're not interested in the lore, you're not interested in the boss, the environment itself is really nice too. So there's that as well. All right. So after that, you run downstairs and there you discover, as David said, what did you say? Barney on roids or Jack Barney on roids?
Yeah. Roided out Barney, Chad Jad. There are a lot of good,
Chad.
A lot of good nicknames.
All right. So how long did it take you to get your first kill, David?
So I did not want to learn any of the mechanics before starting. So I didn't really communicate with anyone or try to figure anything out. It took me a little over 2 hours to get my first kill. And I think the first kill in game was about 40 minutes in.
Yeah, it was about 40 minutes.
By Rudy, who's actually an Iron Man account. So shout out to an Iron Man for being the first to kill the boss.
Yeah, and you know, last week we were talking after our episode on death costs, and I asked you, how long do you think it'll take the first kill on this boss to happen? You said 35 minutes. You weren't far off.
Uh-huh. I wasn't far off. That's true. Yeah.
Okay.
And their estimation of between Araxor and Telos in difficulty, I kind of said was a weird thing because Telos is such a huge variance. But I think that's more or less true. I think it's much harder than Araxor, but I think it's much easier than High Enraged Telos. So
yeah, I saw people joking that, well, technically it is harder than 0% Araxor, and it is easier than the 4,000% Telos, so...
It's true. It is. It's right in there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think I told Shane that it's probably in the 300 to 400 Enraged Telos difficulty range is where I'd put
it. Yeah, and that's... And
which is pretty doable for PVMers.
Yeah.
It's not too bad.
Yeah. All right. So what were your first impressions with this? How did you approach this? And what did you ultimately end up with in terms of an equipment setup for this?
Yeah, so my initial thought was incredibly punishing. I mean, really just brutal for mistakes, which is what they said on stream. On stream, if you remember, they said the mechanics were very simple, but incredibly punishing. And I think that one of my favorite streamers kind of sums it up pretty well, which is that the mechanic is prayer flicking, and all of the other quote-unquote mechanics are just to distract you enough where you mess up a prayer flick and die. And I think that that's pretty much accurate. There's nothing about it that's challenging per se, but it's easy to die very fast because a single missed prayer flick is analogous to a missed prayer flick at Jad in the fight caves, which is why a lot of people are calling it, making references to Jad, because it has a very similar attacking style. And basically it's the kind of thing where if you prayer flick properly, you basically won't need food. And if you don't, you're going to end up in Death's Office pretty much immediately.
Yeah. We'll talk about that because I have some strong opinions on that kind of design, but we'll get there.
Strong opinion.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go back to the bit.
It's not something I really enjoy myself. I much prefer mechanically complex fights like Farrago or Telos or even Solak that aren't just about hard hitting autos that
yeah.
you have to yeah. pay attention to. So it's not really a thing that I imagine myself really enjoying, but it is. It is. There are some good things about it that we can kind of get into.
All right. Well, we'll get there. What would you say is the bare minimum that somebody would want for equipment on this?
Yeah, so it's certainly possible to get kills with pretty minimal setups. So we had a streamer get a kill with tier 70 weapons and void armor, which I would not recommend. That person who accomplished that is, you know, arguably the best PVMer in the game or right up there, top five or so. I think that it is possible to do with I think you could reasonably do it with strong perks on tier 80 power armor and tier 80 weapons, although I think that having a tier 90 main hand weapon is really going to be quite beneficial. I think it's certainly doable with tier 80, although I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing this boss with tier 80 gear. I would kind of suggest doing other things to get the money for tier 90s. But I think tier 90 weapons, tier 80 armor is completely fine.
All right. And because this is a magic-based boss, you're going to want ranged. There is a patch note that is, I think, coming in next week that's going to even out the affinities to make melee on par with magic, but you're still going to prefer ranged for this. Would somebody who is aiming for a mid-range setup be out of their mind to try it with magic or melee at this point?
No, I think magic is totally, totally fine. I think that either Seismics or a Noxious Staff, either one, four ticking if you're used to it. If you're not, just one or the other. There's a lot going on in the fight.
Yeah,
I think Madrid is 100% fine. Ranged is better, not just because of the affinity. With tier 90 weapons, you're 100% accurate. So it doesn't, or at least it appears that you're 100% accurate. I've only done it with Zerg auras, so I'm not totally sure if that's true off of a Zerg aura. But really, I think magic is totally acceptable. The range is just so much stronger than magic in terms of DPM now because of backer minnow bolts that you'll find yourself getting much more effective kills with ascensions as opposed to seismics or a noxious staff. There's really no difficulty that using magic would present you. You're just going to get faster kills with ranged because ranged is just much stronger than magic right now.
All right. So would it be fair to say that a tier 80 weapon with good perks would be good enough, but you really want something in the tier 90 ranged?
Yeah, I think a tier 80 is definitely doable. Like if you wanted to get your kill for Reaper crew, for example, I think you'd have no problem getting one kill with the tier 80 weapon. But I think that if you are looking to really kind of camp the boss, I definitely recommend tier 90s. And if you look, tier 90s are relatively cheap.
Except Ascensions, right?
Right. Ascensions are way up, and we could talk about that in a bit. But a Noxious Staff is maybe 150 mil, which in this era of RuneScape is not super expensive, I don't think.
What about the Nox Bow?
A little cheaper, maybe 130 or so.
Would you use that?
No, I would not use a Noxious Bow.
All right. The reason I ask I'm probing to see what you would use if you weren't going to, you know, go for Serenity, because we know how much those are up.
Yeah, if I only had the budget for a single tier 90 weapon, I would choose a Nox Staff. I just don't think the Nox Bow is particularly good.
All right, but what if you wanted to use ranged and you didn't want to go for the the Ascensions?
The Ascensions. I would say a main hand Ascension crossbow and an offhand Chaotic crossbow would be the way to go. If you can't afford a main hand Ascension crossbow, make a little more money until you can, and then go do that.
Then otherwise use magic. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. I mean,
that's not super. But I think yeah. That's my feeling on it.
All right. And then on the armor front, you said tier 80 power armor with perks at the bare minimum.
Yeah.
And then probably tier 90 power armor would be the recommended, like, what is that, Serenic?
Yeah, or tier 90. Tier 92 is cheaper to use over time, but a bigger upfront cost. We talked
about this
a lot on the monthly bit for those interested in hearing more, but I think tier 80 power armor with strong perks. And these days, because of archaeology, strong perks are incredibly cheap to acquire.
Yeah, what was the percent difference between the old meta before archaeology and the new meta after archaeology with the ancient gizmos?
The new budget meta is significantly stronger than the old max money meta. So the old meta, which was several billion worth of perks, is a significant downgrade compared to the new meta of cheap perks that are maybe 20 mil in total.
That's cheap when it comes to combat, 20 mil for good perks.
Yeah, yeah, and you could have pretty excellent perk setup for under 40 mil for an entire style
and
top bottom.
Remind me what that would be. It would be aftershock.
Yeah, so you're looking at those are expensive.
Okay.
So you're looking at precise 6 and
right,
equilibrium
precise.
4, which are both
P4, P6, E4,
cheap.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, so a P6 and an E4, a P6 on one weapon and E4 on the other, or on a two-handed weapon, you both on the same. And then for your armor, it's really cheap to get Biting 3 these days. There's a kind of trick you have to do to lower your invention level if you're 120 invention.
Really?
You know, it's just how it works. Yeah, it's a higher percent chance at a lower invention level, which is kind of funny. But you could get Biting 3 relatively cheaply. Impatient 4 is quite cheap. You can get it with Zeros components, which are not too bad. And Enhanced Devoted Four, also super cheap, not more than a mil or two. And then Crackling Four, which is maybe 100K or so.
That's the one that provides lightning damage, right?
Yeah, and if you want to spend a little more, you could get the Relentless 5 Crackling 4 combo, and I think those are about 15 mil a perk if you get an average. It's about 1 in 20 chance, so if you maintain that 1 in 20 chance, it's about 15 mil for that perk, which you know you could use or not use. I definitely don't think it's necessary at Raksha. I definitely think it's worth doing if you've got 15 mil to spend, which again is not a whole lot in the grander scheme of PVM costs.
All right.
So, David, I got a question.
Hang on, I just want to ask him about food and potions before you do that. Then you can ask that.
Okay.
What are you using for food? Sailfish, jellyfish?
Yes, I'm using Super Saradomin brews in sailfish soup because I've got them. I don't think that's necessary.
Yeah,
I would
like
not recommend that if you're using a yak. I'm using that because I'm using a Ripper Demon with a lot of spiritual prayer flasks just to spam the Ripper Demon spec for faster kills. If you're using a yak, I think that some regular Saradomin brews and rocktails or sailfish, either one, is more than adequate. I even think that Saradomin brews and sharks is probably totally fine. Because if you, the thing about Raksha is if you don't make mistakes with your prayer flicking, you take almost no damage. And if you do take, if you do make mistakes with prayer flicking, you're probably dead. So how much does the food help? It is hard to say. I mean, I really think that if you're using a yak, just filling a yak full of sharks or rocktails or something like that is totally fine.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's going to be a spectrum based on how good you are at that. And then I assume the best overload that you can either make or that you feel comfortable taking.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
The best overload you can make, yeah.
Right. Super prayer renewal potion? Yes, no, maybe so.
I use Elder Overload salves, so they come with a prayer renewal in them.
Okay.
But I don't really think a prayer renewal is necessary. I use spiritual prayer potions because
those boost your summoning points or restore your summoning points, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yes, and prayer at the same time. If you're not using Ripper Demon, if you're using a yak, then just good old super restores.
All right, Tanis, question.
Oh yeah, I was just thinking, David, when you're going through those setups, I never heard you talk about any switches. So does that mean finally got a boss that you that Switchscape is not necessary to put you into that top tier?
There's not a single boss in the game that requires Switchscape to kill. Now, there's a big spectrum of kill times. I would say our average players are getting between 7 and 8 minute kills. Couchy did a sub 2 minute and 30 second kill. So there's a wide variance in kill times based on how many switches you bring. So if you want to get into what the meta switches are, there are tons.
Oh, so you actually can then do switching.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, I bring a Saren God bow. Once I can afford Greater Ricochet, I'll certainly be bringing a Karaming switch because that thing is obscenely powerful. I definitely bring switches, but we were just talking about kind of the minimum setup.
Yeah, the minimum
for consistency.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't think we were getting to the kind of high end setups yet.
No, we're not. And what I wanted to do next is I wanted to ask you, Questscaping, what were you using on your attempts?
Oh boy. Funny you should mention switches because this isn't exactly high end, but I was using a shield switch. That's because generally in the kills I was doing, I was running into a mechanic that wasn't a mechanic that you only encounter if you're not quite doing enough DPS. I was encountering that both in my duos and my solos and finally managing to push past it a bit, but it is useful to have just for a bit of a resonance if you're being a bit on the slow side.
Is that the shockwave mechanic?
Yes.
Yeah, so I actually didn't know about that mechanic because I've never seen it. But I watched a YouTuber video and he explained how to deal with that mechanic. And I was just
looking puzzled because I just didn't know it existed. But you definitely want a shield for that mechanic.
I was the opposite. I didn't know people were not encountering that.
Yeah. Well, you know, my setup was pretty expensive, so it's a little easier to put out high DPS.
And there's actually been a good image floating around that was made by Sweaty Fetty on the PVM Discord that details all of the mechanics and phases of the boss. And at the end, you see that shockwave there. I'm assuming that just doesn't happen if you have enough DPS, right?
Yeah, you just skip it entirely. Okay. So I've never seen it because I just went in with a Ripper Demon from the get-go and tried to DPS hard because that's just my approach to the game.
All right. But what kind of equipment are you using, Questscaping?
Well, my equipment is Tier 90 Serenic and Ascension Crossbows, and I use Ruby the Criminal Bolt generally for PVM. But the problem is, I'm kind of terrible and haven't actually upgraded my perks since before archaeology happened. So I still have what I think is just the old bargain perks, which is nowhere near what you can get these days. So I'm aware I'm not putting out anywhere near as much damage as I could be. And I feel like I might be able to do it. Like hearing about you talking about how even the bargain perks these days are miles above the high end as they used to be. I feel like maybe that was what might push me over the edge because I am sort of almost getting kills, just messing up here and there.
Yeah, I mean, I think your setup's perfect for consistent kills. It's really easy to upgrade to something like Enhanced Devoted 4, Crackling 4, or Biting 3, Impatient 4. Those things are all really cheap these days and well worth it. I also would consider you doing a bolt switch. It might be too cumbersome for you, but the advantage of Hydrix Backramental bolts inside of a Death Swiftness is pretty tremendous. If you're not bringing spec weapons, it's hard to take advantage of that bonus, though. So that's kind of the downside of using those bolts, but I think Ruby are totally fine if you're more comfortable just keeping one type.
What kind of bolts were you using, David?
Ruby and Hydrix. Hydrix while inside Death Swiftness, Ruby when outside of Death Swiftness.
All right.
And the reason for that is that Hydrix special effect gives you additional adrenaline, which lets you pump out things like Dark Bow specs and SGB specs virtually for free. So I have an Essence of Finality with a Dark Bow in it.
That was going to be my next question. Are you bringing? Are you using any Essence of Finalities here?
Yeah. So Dark Bow and SGB.
Right. I was going to say, that's not the question. How many is the question?
You don't necessarily need an SGB inside of an EOF. You could just use the regular SGB. The advantage of it in the EOF, of course, is the tremendous power of Backramental bolts with your SGB spec. So, you know, you could hit 15K five times with an SGB spec these days because of EOF.
All right. Questscaping, anything else you want to share on your setup, or do you have any questions for David?
On my setup, well, I think I've just got about everything, like enough to potentially pump out decent kills. Gotta get the mechanics down, basically.
All right.
As I said, not really gear dependent, is it? No, definitely.
Your gear is totally fine. Yeah, your gear is really good. Ascensions are awesome right now. They're really excellent.
Yes.
There's a reason
the
they're tuned
are a game changer
right now. Great. Absolutely.
All right. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, the tier 90 power armor setup ascensions. Is there anything that you're using that's just say over the top that you would expect to see in a high end PVM setup, David?
Yeah, so a few. So one is bringing a Noxious Scythe with Laceration Boots. The way that Bladed Dive works, if you look at the tooltip, is that whenever you kill a target within a certain number of seconds of using Bladed Dive, it resets the cooldown. And so the Shadow Animal pools, which you have to kill in order to prevent the mechanics from being more punishing, you don't need to do it, but it just makes it so much harder if you don't. Questscaping, I imagine you know what I'm referring to, the little Shadow Animal pools that you have to kill that have 1,000 health.
Are these kind of like those things on the Queen Black Dragon that you need to kill?
They're more just these things that Raksha absorb. They're more like, in Demonheim, how some of the demon bosses, when they stand on the like green pools, they gain abilities.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to that. So there'll be these Shadow Anima pools, and every once in a while, Raksha will absorb them, increasing his defense and the amount of damage he does to you. But if you kill the pools before he can absorb them, then that doesn't happen. So it just makes the fight easier if you kill them. It makes it harder if you don't. They don't do anything to
kill them.
Yeah. Right. And so if you use Laceration Boots and a Noxious Scythe, you can just Bladed Dive to each of the pools, and Bladed Dive gets reset from killing the targets. And even in full ranged gear, you have 100% accuracy with the scythe.
Right.
And so you can kill them extremely fast during the rockfall animation because you have to run around anyway, so you might as well be doing something productive. And so you could kill them extremely quickly with a Nox scythe. Some other things just I kind of... Yeah, so if you watch, a lot of the streamers, they're kind of employing this tactic, and it just makes it makes it so you could really focus DPS much better because you're not wasting abilities killing Shadow Anima pools because you're basically just insta-killing them with Bladed Dive.
Yeah, I found that in some of my more advanced kills, or attempts anyway, it's really been a choice between killing the Shadow Anima or just pushing the DPS over the edge that I managed to avoid the shockwave. And I think this would be a real time saver. And actually allow the DPS to go towards something productive, which is killing the boss.
Right. And of course, the downside is that it's a more expensive death if you die without a ring of death, and it's more complicated because you're dealing with another switch. But it's really good. And also, if you have trouble dealing with two switches, I think it's totally fine to just wear Laceration Boots and just switch with the Nox Scythe.
Right, so take a bit of time.
But some other things I mentioned are... Yeah, some other things I mentioned, Darkbow, EOF, and SGB or SGB and an EOF, either one is really good. I mean, SGB just does massive damage, especially after you get the damage buff at the end of phase 4, I think SGB basically never hits below 60k damage. So there's a reason that it's up over 500 mil from its price prior to Raksha. It's just even better than it already was.
Amazing.
And then I don't have this yet because I don't have the money for... Well, I mean, I could buy it, but I'd rather wait a bit for it to come down in price. But Greater Ricochet... So Greater Ricochet is one of the most powerful things that they've ever released in.
Yeah, we'll
in
talk
the
more
history.
About that at the notable drop section because I think that definitely needs to be mentioned and all.
Yeah, so a lot of people are bringing Greater Ricochet to Switch. So you switch to a different Ascension or offhand Blightbound crossbow, or in some instances, a second Eldritch crossbow for those who just have two bill to drop on a switch.
No problem, right?
Take advantage.
I mean,
for some of us on this podcast, it is no problem. for the rest of us, it's not. It is a problem.
Folks, he's not talking about himself, just so you know.
Greater Ricochet with Caroming 4 is just an enormous damage boost. So that would be a switch that you would see in a high-end setup.
All right. Anything else, or do you want to move on to mechanics? Because we can talk a bit about the mechanics, but I think the mechanics are very well telegraphed in this image here.
Oh yeah, that image is perfect. Okay. There's no change.
All right. Well, if you don't,
I would just say.
Okay. Go ahead.
The only thing about the mechanics is we talked about this a little bit. It's just a prayer flick boss. It's like Jad, but hits much harder and much faster, and stuns you sometimes if you aren't aware of when the stun's going to happen. The way you die as a learner, and maybe Questscaping, you might agree with me on this, is just forgetting about the tail whip slash charge. Because that hits you for between 6 and 9.5k and stuns you for 6 seconds, so it's almost certainly a death. Yeah. It's very easy to avoid. You just step two squares away from the boss, and it does zero damage to you. But should you forget about the tail whip, you're probably in Death's Office or Prif or wherever your Ring of Death is teleporting you to. So if you're learning... I would definitely recommend focusing on making sure that you're not dying to the tail whip slash charge. And if you do that and focus on your prayer switches, all of the other mechanics are really quite simple to avoid. And then one other tip for learners is if you're having trouble with the rock fall, Power Burst of Vitality allows you to tank every single rock that he throws at you without moving. And so you could just... as soon as the rock fall animation starts and it's well telegraphed, just take a sip of a Power Burst of Vitality and keep DPSing as if nothing's happening.
See, that's what we said when this came out. It would be important for combating things like this.
Right. Power Burst of Vitality. And another option is to use Reflect. But I, of course, am taking advantage of that animation to use my Laceration Boot Scythe switch to kill all the Shadow Anima.
All right.
And I think if you're going faster kills, that's the best use of that.
Now, I have a question about this. And this, what exactly does it mean by Shadow Bomb?
So good question. The Shadow Bombs are this is an instance where Shadow Anima comes in, Shane. So the way that the Shadow Bombs work is you get stunned. It's again pretty well telegraphed. It's easy to anticipate or freedom prior to the stun, so it doesn't happen. And alongside Raksha's normal auto attacks, so melee ranged mage, he drops shadow bombs that hit a spot on the ground. And if you're standing on that spot on the ground where the bomb hits, you take very rapid 2.5 to 3K hits every single tick. The way to avoid it is simply moving. So if you've ever done Legios, you're aware of the mechanic where Legios drop lightning on the floor and it does nothing to you if you avoid it, but it kills you if you stand on the same square. It's the exact same type of thing. He drops a kind of shadow anima bomb on the floor. All you have to do is run away from that square before it hits. And it's really, really easy. Basically, as soon as the mechanic starts, you just anticipate prior or freedom as soon as you get stunned. And just run in a circle around him, and it will do absolutely nothing to you. But it's important to remember that while he's shadow bombing, he's continuing to do auto attacks.
Right.
You can't forget to prayer flick. So that's kind of what I mean by the mechanic is prayer flicking, and then a bunch of kind of really, really simple things to get you distracted enough that you die to him and miss prayer flick.
Okay. Also in phase two, this graphic mentions mind poison. I assume that's just something you need to avoid, or...
So the mind poison stuff in phase two, is just something, it's similar to the shadow bombs where you just have to run around and avoid being stunned by it. The current way to deal with it is you just run around in a circle. The insta-kill mechanic is really easy to deal with. You just have to do 30k damage in a certain amount of time, which... with tier 90 weapons, you should have no problem doing. Just a couple thresholds will get you there. If you don't have tier 90s, you could just stand behind a pillar. And again, like that dungeoneering boss, that's the big giant eyeball. You know, with the pillars around, when you stand behind the pillar, the thing that hits you really hard doesn't even hit you. It's the same thing with Raksha. And it's also very well telegraphed when the insta-kill is coming. So you either do 30k damage... There's no problem with tier 90s, or you stand behind a pillar, wait for the animation to finish, and then continue as normal.
All right. And how do you know if it's going to do a tail swipe or a charge at you?
So if you are within two squares, it's a tail swipe. If you are out of range of his tail swipe, he charges because he can't hit you with a tail swipe.
And could you evade that charge?
Surging in any direction evades the charge.
Okay, got it.
I have occasionally been caught off guard by that because I'm attacking with range. It's often not quite clear if Raksha is on the borderline on the side of doing this tail swipe or on the side of doing the charge. So sometimes I get caught a little off guard and get tail swiped when I didn't think I was in range, for instance. But usually it's pretty well telegraphed which one it's going to do. You can tell from the animations, and that's something I've stopped really falling prey to.
Yeah, and you know, that's always been something for me.
Almost all my deaths in the first 30 minutes were to precisely what Questscaping is describing, which is confusion between whether it's going to be a tail swipe or a charge. Almost every single time I died in the first hour of the fight.
I don't get personally, and it's hard to see on a boss that's that big, is whether it be this or something else, I find it hard to tell if I'm in melee distance or if I'm fighting from afar.
It just ends up being kind of a feel thing after a certain number of attempts. Because after enough deaths to that, I probably died at least a dozen times to that. You kind of figure it out.
Yeah. And everything that we're seeing here, this doesn't seem that complicated. And that's why you say it's a prayer flicking boss or prayer switching boss.
Yeah.
Now,
it's the advantage to this, though, is it does build core PVM skills very nicely.
Okay.
Prayer flicking is super important in PVM, and other than phase 4 Araxi, we don't really have a boss in the game that forces prayer flicking that anyone would consider to be a lower leveled or a mid-level. I mean, I would say this is upper level. This is certainly not mid-level content. This is high tier content.
Yeah.
If you want to really practice prayer flicking and get really good at it, Raksha really forces you to do that.
Yeah, and my question with this, are we talking prayer flicking in that you need to be on, say, protect from melee for, I don't know, 2 ticks and then back to ranged? I'm just using those as examples. Or is the time more than 2 ticks? Like, how much time are we talking about between flicks?
It's considerably slower.
It's more than 2 ticks. Yeah, it's a lot slower than that. The melee hit is almost impossible to see. So if you're in melee range, you need to have prey melee up at all times and then switch to mage or range and then back to melee based on the animation. But I have time to soul split flick in between my prayer flicks. So if that gives you an idea of how much time you have, it's relatively significant. It seems really fast at first, though, because most people aren't used to prayer flicking between 3 different styles.
So you're saying you can tell tell what it's going to be based on the animation, if you're not in melee distance.
Absolutely. In the same way that you could tell with Jad.
Right.
It's basically the same attack speed as Jad, maybe slightly faster, but not really. And it's the same as Jad, where protection prayers massively reduce damage. It's definitely more than 60% or whatever it is.
And they talked about that on the stream this week, that you are actually rewarded for praying correctly.
Correct.
You get hit about 1,000 when praying correctly, and you get hit about 4,000 when praying incorrect.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Between 800 and 1,100 when you pray right, between 3,500 and 4,500 when you pray wrong. And melee hits hit harder, so you could hit if you pray wrong and it's a melee hit, it could easily hit over 5K.
And this is the part where I have these stern words, because you know before the evolution of combat came out, the whole premise of combat, and keep in mind we were talking about the Kalphite King at the time, because that boss came out before the evolution of combat. The whole idea behind that was that you had to, you know, navigate the interface and be able to activate your prayers at the right time to find success. And, you know, we've been seeing this over the last number of years when it comes to PVM. Are we really back to that? And, you know, I'm not saying that sarcastically. I realize it might have sounded that way. But are we back to the point where it comes down to being able to change prayers correctly? Because you mentioned this is a thing in most every other boss out there.
Yeah, I mean, this is really just hard mode Jad. So it's really a throwback in terms of mechanics. I think of all the EOC bosses, I think you could reasonably argue that it has the simplest mechanics of any of the high tier bosses that have come out. So if that means AOD, Virago, Solak, Araxor, Telos, I think Raksha mechanics are by far the easiest. But at the same time, weirdly, one of, among the most punishing, just because it's so prey flick dominant. When I'm referring to prayer flicking at other bosses, it's primarily between a single style and soul split.
Right.
So Telos, Virago, Solak, whatever, you're praying a single style and flicking back and forth between soul split to save food. Raksha is totally different because you're prayer flicking between different combat styles, and it's extremely punishing if you miss a single one. So it's very reminiscent of pre-EOC combat in a
yeah.
way that no other boss in the game is. That's why I think hard mode Jad is a really good just analog for it, because it really does feel like you're fighting Jad, but a 2020 much, much stronger version of it.
Right. And then when you throw in the internet and you throw in the tick system, you know, that can be very punishing with this too. So... And, you know, based on kind of that and seeing how it's so dependent on this, I kind of really don't have myself, and, you know, keep in mind my level of PVM is the Queen Black Dragon currently, I really don't have any inclination to try this with that much prayer flicking involved, because it just goes back, like you said, to that pre-EOC style of combat.
Yeah, I agree. I don't particularly enjoy this kind of thing. I don't find it to be that interesting or engaging, but I do think that some people will like this much more than dealing with something like Telos, where mechanics are much more complicated and things are always changing.
Right. And, you know, looking at it from another side, this could be an interesting way of getting old school people to PVM and RS3.
Yeah, that's true.
Well,
that's true. That's an interesting point.
So I know this is, you know, a high tier, top tier boss, David. What do you think, like, the population really is that can actually engage with this boss? I'm asking because I saw a tweet from a certain former JMod this week that said, you know, RuneScape gets two kinds of updates, skilling updates, and bosses that only 5% of the players can do.
So I would say that it depends what you mean by engagement. If you're trying to compare yourself to the top tier people who are getting sub 4-minute kills or sub 330 kills in some instances, very, very few, I think, will ever achieve that level. But I think a very high percentage of players can get in the 7 to 8 minute kill range with a few hours of spending money on Onyxes or Death's Office or doing practice mode. I think if you just spend a whole day engaging with the boss, I think that a high percentage of players who have access to tier 90 weapons and good perks and 96 summoning for a pack yak, you know, other things like overloads, etc. I think a very high percentage of players can at least get kills, which
yeah,
is not the case
say,
for
yeah.
something like Telos, which I think is way, way harder at you know, the 1K enrage mark, for example.
I do want to say, as someone who is
ahead.
Definitely not in that 5% of top players, I feel like, because I've done a bit of PVM, I've done a bit of racks and stuff, and I feel like it's about the same learning curve, the same level of difficulty there, getting used to it as I was when learning racks. And I feel that a lot of the difficulty people are perceiving at this point is just newness, really. of not really having the muscle memory down yet, of not being used to it yet.
Well, yeah, you can write the entire mechanics out on a single page.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the first phase of Telos is more complicated than the entire boss fight at Rexxon.
There you go. And, you know, I think that's why they were justified in saying Araxor level to Telos level in between there. And granted, player perception does color that, and they admitted that on the live stream this week. I want to move on to the part of the show that we actually need to discuss on this, and that's the notable drops from this. The greater abilities plus divert. So greater chain is a magic ability. It hits the primary target and two secondary targets within a 6-square radius for 20 to 100% ability damage, plus 50% of the next magic hit against the primary target within 6 seconds will be dealt to both secondary targets. And greater chain stacks with the Karoming perk. And they say if you're using an inventor, you'd basically be an unstoppable skilling machine. And you said to me, David, on day of release that this is a Slayer ability and you really have no use for this in PVM.
Yeah, I think the best PVM use for it is to kill the mage healers at Jad.
Okay, that, you know, when we're talking about PVM, that's fairly low level in the Stan Age. So.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, unless you're doing really old 2016 Telos strategies where you're killing golems on phase four, which some people still do, I suppose. I don't know why you would. There are a lot of YouTube guides about how to do the new method. But if you're doing really old Telos methods, then this would actually be super helpful for that. But I don't really know if that's even counts as being good. It seems decent for Slayer, I guess, but are you really going to spend 300 mil for an extra switch to kill Abyssal Demons? Like, I don't know about that.
I don't think you need that, but
yeah. And I think the Codex is already down to maybe 150, 160.
Yeah. That's the price that I heard on this. And the reason we're talking about it in this context is because we want to put this up and show how much different it is to greater Ricochet, which is now one of your PVM staples, if I understand correctly, for ranged.
Yeah, if you could afford it, obviously. And bear in mind, ranged was already much stronger than magic before this boss came out. Ranged was already by far better than magic, like, to the point where it's not even close.
Right, and like I remember a few years ago we were talking about magic being the be-all. And
yeah, I was like, wait a minute, what happened?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, back in 2017, the opposite was the case, for sure.
Yeah, and okay. I mean, it's good they've adjusted that over time. And for comparison's sake, last I heard, this Greater Ricochet Codex was in the range of 1.5 bill. So you can see the differences on there.
Yeah, it's dropped a lot. It's more like 900 mil now.
Okay, but still way more expensive.
Yeah, it'll always be way, way more expensive. And it's just, I mean, it's just, you could read what it does for the listeners, but I mean, it makes me nervous. The level of power creep Greater Ricochet introduces makes me nervous about the future of content, because if each boss needs to drop something better than the previous one to justify its existence, I mean, this is just kind of out of control.
From that perspective. So it does the 20 to 100% ability damage for your primary target and two nearby secondary targets, and it stacks with the Karoming perk. But it also, for each secondary target, the ability does not find your primary target, will take an additional hit for 10 to 50% ability damage.
Right. And let's not forget that also stacks with Karaming. So your primary target in a solo instance, like Raksha, takes 6 additional hits. So one ability will hit the boss, and it's a basic that gives you adrenaline and has a 10-second cooldown, will hit your target 7 times. So, you know, is just it's
you just
like
have to do the math, and it kind of says what the big deal of this is, right?
Right, and it avoids the damage cap of 15k or 12k without a grimoire because each hit is separately calculated. So it's not like it caps at 15k. You just get seven individual hits.
The wiki page for this is pretty much just a table of abilities this is better than.
Yeah. The fact
and
that
this is a big, beating a lot of thresholds.
Well, it's the best. It's better than any threshold in the game, basically, as a basic. So, take that for what you will, I guess. I think it is the best threshold in the game if you are using it on Karaming.
Yeah, and he didn't misspeak there, folks. He's saying it's as good or better than a threshold for basic adrenaline use.
Right, and it's a 10-second cooldown. So streamers and YouTubers have broken pretty much every boss record in the game. Every Telos record was broken yesterday with this new ability. And Raksha kill times with ranged are over a minute and a half faster than with magic because of this ability in part.
I'm of two schools of thought on this. You know, you have to protect against power creep, but at the same time, the only way to go is up, because I think EOC is fairly well horizontally defined in terms of all the different combat styles out there and all the different choices you can make.
Yeah, I'm just confused why they didn't make greater chain and greater ricochet identical.
Yeah, that's a fair point, honestly.
Because then you have power creep, but at least it's horizontal. I mean, now mage gets something that's basically useless. Maybe you do your Abyssal Demon's task faster, I guess, or your Corrupted Scorpion's task, or your Dark Beast task. But other than that, you're not using it. And ranged gets the single biggest individual ability upgrade. I mean, I don't know if it's as strong as Mutated Barge, but it's certainly the strongest since Mutated Barge. And there's probably a case for it to be as good as Mutated Barge or better.
All right. And, you know, I think we just have to take a moment, wait and see where the balancing comes in, if any, on this, see how it affects PVM as a whole, see if maybe there needs to be a buff as well, like you said, to greater chain, because they could definitely add that into it, though perhaps they didn't because there's already an inherent AoE with some of the magic spells that we have in game that maybe there was something with that taken into effect. I'm not sure on that. But what about Divert, a new defense ability that requires a shield, 48 defense. When active, the next attack dealt to you within 6 seconds will convert the damage you would have taken to adrenaline, letting you wind up your next move more than faster. And this does share a 30-second cooldown with Resonance.
Yeah, so this one's interesting. I think that the tooltip is poorly written and a little confusing, and I hope that they change it. There's kind of two places I can imagine it being interesting. The first is phase five of Telos if you're doing a natural instinct rotation, because natural instinct would make the divert even stronger. And the second is if you're going for speed kills, when you do nat instinct on a dummy prior to starting the fight and then you use divert, then you could get even more adren. So maybe it could be good. I think it's pretty niche, though, and currently I'm not really sure how useful it is. The real star of the show of the three is pretty clearly Ricochet. That thing is a monstrosity. The other two, are just okay.
All right. And, you know, we'll keep our eye on this, and, you know, I think that would you say it's meta-changing or no?
Ricochet is meta-changing.
Yeah, greater Ricochet. I mean, is that meta-changing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, for anyone who was on the fence about ranged meta, this has cemented it, more than cemented it.
Yeah, and that's probably the reason the Ascensions have also shot up, too, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I expect ranged gear to go up by at least 40 or 50%. And ranged gear was already way more expensive than the other two styles. So it's a little unfortunate for people trying to get into PVM gear, but if you already have your Ascensions like Questscaping, then good for you. You're They went from about 140 to about 215, and I expect them to continue to rise.
Selbo.
The Eldritch Crossbow went from 1.7 to right around max cash. The Blightbound Crossbows went from like 600 mil to like 900 mil. So
the Eldritch Crossbow is the one from Solak, right?
Blightbounds are from Solak. Eldritch Crossbow is Elite Dungeon 3.
Oh, okay, right. All right. Other interesting drops that come from this. There's a chance for Onyx Dust, Crystal Keys. First time ever being dropped by something, or a Calcum Salvage.
Ooh. Yep.
Okay.
Also, small
Spirit
Blunt
Weed Seeds was nice to see.
Yeah, Spirit Weed Seeds. Those are already expensive enough as they are, so I mean, we can put those down a bit.
They've gone down a lot in price, which makes sense. You're not going to forget to mention the boots, right, Jane?
I'm getting there. Dark and light Anelika stone spirits as well, but these also, of course, do drop the Laceration, Blast Effusion, and Fleeting Boots that you could previously only get from the dinosaurs.
And Fleeting are new.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, Fleeting are brand new boots that allow you to use Rapid Fire while moving, because for some reason, not only did we need to give Ranged an unbelievably meta-changing codex, but we also had to make Ranged even more versatile. So at this point, there's just no argument left for using magic. I mean, Ranged is just absurd, because being able to move while using a channeled ability is, I mean, it's never been done before. There's no example.
And you know, there's some questions about that.
While using
a
channeled ability, and that's huge. I mean, that's so huge that they did that, and the fact that they gave it to Ranged is, I think, it's a little absurd.
Isn't that the nightmare gauntlets that you use with Snipe?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Snipe is a channeled ability. So that's fair enough. So Nightmare Gauntlets do allow you to use a channeled ability off while moving. But this is a channeled threshold, which I think kicks it up to a whole different level.
And you know what I'd like to see with this? I'd like to maybe hear a bit of the rationale behind these decisions from the Combat Council on this, to know that, you know, we're just not diving in deep and, you know, buffing, you know, to willy-nilly. Because also with this, there's the Shadow Spike, which will upgrade the boots that we just mentioned from tier 80 to tier 90 boots.
Yeah. That's not too big of a deal. I mean, tier 80 versus tier 90 stats is so insignificant in terms of DPM. I mean, it's like fine. It's really not that big of a deal to me. I'm not too worried about it. I think the much bigger deal is the fact that Ranged has no channeled ability that requires you to be stationary. So Ranged now just has no ability that requires you to be in place, because the two channeled Ranged abilities, Snipe and Rapid Fire, can now both be used while moving, which has a lot of application. Like, for example, at Nex, regular mode Nex, something that's kind of annoying for some people is that if you're using Rapid Fire and then Nex puts a shadow pool underneath your feet, you then have to move, thus canceling your rapid fire and wasting a lot of damage. If you have Fleeting Boots, that's no longer a problem, because, you know, why not make Ranged even better than it already is, I guess.
I think the best way to develop the different combat styles going forward is to give each one a niche, and I think they might be trying to do that there with magic and the area of effect, but it's also not something that really matters in the high-level meta, just really Slayer. And Ranged, on the other hand, is not really going into a niche so much as it's becoming the best in just about anything.
Yeah, and you know, you could further work on Ranged by bringing in those changes from the agility skill that we talked about last month, effectively making it the rogue skill, you know, add some movement abilities to it. And then that would make sense why you can have channeled abilities and be moving around. So maybe there is something interesting.
My hope
with this
is that God Wars Dungeon 3 will make use of Greater Chain in some way that we currently can't foresee. Like, maybe the boss has healers similar to Jad or something like that, or minions you have to kill. I don't really know. I'm hoping for something, because I personally enjoy Magic more than any other style, because I just like the aesthetic of the abilities and I'm comfortable with it. And I think picking is super fun. It's my favorite way to PVM, but it's getting so bad compared to the other two styles that it's just, it's a little disheartening. And I think maybe it would have been nice for it to be a melee based boss. I mean, really it could have been anything, based on its mechanics. So it would have been nice if Inquisitor staff worked. But you know, Inquisitor staff already works a lot. So maybe they thought it would make it too good or something, but
yeah,
I don't know. That could have been something to at least somewhat bring it into balance.
All right.
Thanos can be very upset about Rash.
Oh, that's amusing. We're going to have a chat about the lore in just a moment, but I'd also like to point out that with this boss, this is, as somebody put it, dubstep has come to RuneScape.
Well, it's the metal, too, isn't it?
Yeah. This is, of course, the login screen music.
So,
go ahead.
Something that I found hilarious was I was listening to the fight because oftentimes new fights, they tell you things that you're supposed to do. And that was the case in Raksha as well. So I played with sound on. My music kept glitching where when I went to phase two, it kept playing the newbie melody. And I was thinking... Like, is my DPS so bad that they're playing the newbie melody? Like, I don't know if that happened to anyone else, but every single time, about 4 or 5 minutes into the fight, it switched from the Raksha theme to the newbie melody, and I have no idea why.
That's incredible.
I really found it a little offensive.
I bet that's tough once you stop dying, right?
Maybe. I don't know. But it was a little sad. I was like, why is it? I was thinking maybe after a certain point, if you haven't gotten the kill yet, they just switch it to newbie. Like,
that'd be great.
Wow. All right.
I can't fathom how that would be happening, but it's incredible.
I have no idea either. Heard, it makes no sense.
I heard an anecdote from one of the audio team JMods once about how Sliskay's endgame, the part where you race for the stone in the end, that was actually put over something that had formerly been used for one of the holiday events, the Gilnor Games. And so instead of the climactic music track you're meant to be hearing there, it was playing the cheese roll theme.
You know, I
so
actually
I'm wondering
remember-
if...
I remember that.
Yeah. Oh.
That's fantastic.
Oh, my God. Well, nonetheless, it's an impressive musical score. I will say that. Very unique. The three tracks, if you want to look them up, are the Shadow Colossus. That is, of course, the Login theme as well as the Raksha theme. There's Apex Predator and Orthon Oublette, which plays when you're doing the... mini quest. So three new music tracks with this one too. So that's pretty fun.
I do want to mention something about Orthon Oubliette, because that's a track that uses a couple of leitmotifs. You've got the Vault of Varanus that we heard from Orthon.
I caught that.
Yeah. And and we also got Zaros Stirs, which is the classic anything with Zaros in it track.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's been used for a while, not since Next Angel of Death. So there's an old friend to hear her again.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's very good that you noticed that. And I didn't catch the Zaros one, but I definitely caught the Varanus one. Is there anything else that we would like to talk about when it comes to the lore of the boss? Because I know there's some things that were lore related that they said were going to be sprinkled in throughout the fight. Did you pick up on any of those questscaping?
Yes, there was one particular line that happens in, I think, phase 4 or 5. Either way, it's a bit of the boss fight that I've barely been able to get to. And the line is, I will drag you into Erebus. So does that mean anything in particular to you?
No.
There are a few people who've been... Yeah, so this is extremely niche things that the lore community would know about. But yeah, a few years ago, there was talk of a guardian of Gothics named Erebus, who essentially functioned as a living prison, and Gothics would put all the nasty types in there to, yeah, be locked away and whatnot. And I remember, I look around the lore channels of the official lore Discord sometimes. Mod Jack was in there saying before the release that there is a particular line in the fight, though it might not mean what you think it means. So maybe
this has to be
maybe
it.
They are following up on this old idea, yeah, of Erebus, or maybe they've tweaked it somehow, because the lore of Raksha, that predates Gothic's arriving on Gyllenor by a long shot.
Yeah, and
so maybe it's, yeah, yeah.
And I don't think
not
there's anything else in the fight
Gothics
that is as impactful as perhaps that one is. So I think that's probably the one that we need to look at. And, you know, just looking up Erebus on the wiki, 2016 Mod Osborne said that prior to the release of The World Wakes, there were plans for a quest called In the Mouth of Madness regarding Erebus, who was the floating prison. So this was potentially canonical with this and would have been before The World Wakes. So who knows what that
I'm thinking
would be about.
The concept of the prison, I think that might actually tie into the Codex, because we have the track record of Raksha was trapped in there, now Guildmaster Tony is trapped in there. Perhaps it's, yeah.
Perhaps that's a line that was imparted on Raksha by the Codex.
Perhaps. Hmm. Or perhaps Raksha is about to give us the same sort of experience we're intending to.
All right. I know you have to depart soon, David, but is there anything else combat-wise, ability-wise, setup-wise, drop-wise you'd like to bring in on this?
Good to go to the questions. I think I've kind of said as much as I can say at this point.
All right. And, you know, since there is one question that is specifically tailored for you, we'll deal with this one now. How many, and this is from Miss Alaska at Clan Quest, how many deaths have you experienced so far?
I would say around 60.
60?
Yeah.
And how much were each of these costing?
Maximum death cost?
When I died and went to death's office, around 7 mil. When I used a Onyx, 15% of 4.1 mil, whatever that is. I mean, mostly it was Ring of Death, obviously. But, you know, from time to time you mess up. And
so probably around 50 mil in death costs, at least for you.
Probably more.
Smart move, though. It wasn't a 15.
Yeah, probably more than that. But yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a challenging fight to learn. It's really simple, but really punishing. So I will say it is definitely an accessible fight. Like, I think from what Questscaping has said, that kind of demonstrates how accessible it is. But yeah, I think, and also... I didn't try to really learn the mechanics slowly. I just went for speed kills from the very start with a Ripper Demon and such. So,
right.
You know, I think if you take it slow and steady, you're much less likely to die.
And before you go, we'll just quickly dive into the live stream in the last 5 minutes here. They're going to be changing it next week to make it so that as it is right now, they feel 0% shadow energy is too punishing. We didn't talk about that, how that's a mechanic that builds up if you don't kill energy. If you don't kill the pools, there's this thing that builds up.
We did talk about it.
Okay, we did.
Yeah, we talked about it at length, actually. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's the pools of shadow energy.
Yeah, that's
around.
The. Remember how I was telling you how I bring a scythe and laceration boots?
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Shane.
Yeah, I know. Slap me across the side of the head.
I'm not going to forget something like that, Shane.
All right.
You know me better than that.
100% shadow energy. Shadow energy will be 100% damage, and the goal making 0% easier. And the goal is to allow small mistakes, but not be punished as much for when you make them.
Yeah, I mean, I have two criticisms of this. First, announcing a nerf within 24 hours of release is ridiculous to me. Unless it's way harder than intended, then fine. But I think really,
I don't really have that much patience for people thinking that they should be able to kill a boss immediately upon release. Like, if you looked, some of the best streamers in the game, like RS Guy, who's not super elite but very, very good, racked up 55 deaths on day of release. So it wasn't like it was meant to be hard. I don't know. And so I don't really like that it was announced within 24 hours. I think they should have waited a little while to get more data. The second issue is that this doesn't really help people who are struggling all that much, because the way the Shadow Anima mechanic works is the longer the fight goes, the more it builds. And so people like Evil Lucario or Couchy, who are getting incredibly fast kills, are going to benefit from this. But people who are getting really slow kills are going to see that Shadow Anima go really high anyway. So they aren't actually going to people who are doing slow kills are not going to benefit from this. And people who are already doing really fast kills, it's just going to get even easier. I think that even if they want to nerf it, I'm not really sure if this solves the problem.
Yeah, what's effectively happening is they're taking the base damage down from 3750 to 2812, and then it scales up based on that, reaching the same point at a shadow energy percentage.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely less punishing, but I don't know. I don't think it was necessary to do this so quickly. And then the Rockfall nerf makes some sense, but at the same time, Power Burst of Vitality is pretty good. It's one inventory slot, and if you're bringing a Yak, I feel like one inventory slot isn't going to be the difference. And you could also use Barricade or Reflect, and
that's just if you can't see it. And I mean, in what I've watched, I was able to see where it was landing.
Yeah, it's not all that hard. And even if you're having trouble seeing it, like I can't really see it because my laptop isn't very good. But I was just using Reflect early on, and Reflect makes it so you can eat through the damage without too much difficulty.
Right.
So I don't hate it, but I just think it's too soon and wish that they had collected more data first.
Yeah, and they say the shadow pools are the main mechanic that you're supposed to deal with.
Right, exactly.
It was also asked if they could make an achievement where you were
incentivized dealing with it.
They were also asked if they could make an achievement where you were not allowed to kill any Shadow Pool and finish the fight.
That sounds really fun, actually.
Okay.
I don't think it's that hard, actually. It's really not that hard.
And
it's the same as the stuffed anima achievement at Telos. So at Telos, there's an anima bar, and the stuffed with anima achievement is when you let Telos fill that anima bar to full on each of the five phases, which is a really easy achievement to do once you know what you're doing.
Right.
So I think that'd be fun.
And they said they're monitoring the Greater Ricochet and Greater Chain, how they're performing, and there's discussions, and this is being monitored internally. They're not going to say anything about it as of yet because, I mean, I guess they want the market to be the dominant force here.
So. Yeah, I think Ricochet has to be nerfed.
I was going to say that. That's coming with the nerf on Monday. You watch.
I don't know that it will.
I don't think it'll be nerfed on Monday, but I think it should be nerfed. I think there's a really easy way to nerf it, and that's just instead of making it seven different hits, which are each calculated separately, make it so the sum total of those seven hits can't exceed 12K or 15K with a Grimoire. Because that's still incredibly strong. I mean, a 15K basic for no cost. You just get a 15K basic for free. What's absurd to me is getting a 35K basic for free. I mean, what is going on there? So I think just making it so they can't exceed the hit cap in total would be fine. Because it'd still be really strong and really meta-defining, but it wouldn't be obscene, which is what it is now.
Yeah.
Before I had to go, I just wanted to ask Questscaping if, and it's based on a question that y'all are about to discuss, is the Warden of God Wars Dungeon 3 going to be Guildmaster Tony as a Colossus? I want to kill Guildmaster Tony.
What's he done wrong?
I love that idea. Imagine promising to teach me something and then getting yourself trapped in an obelisk and giving me nothing.
Fair enough.
I have a bone to pick with Mr. Tony, and he hasn't given me his pickaxe once. I've tried hundreds of times to get his pickaxe. He says no. So yeah, I have all kinds of problems with Tony, actually. Multiple accounts attempted to get his pickaxe, and he just denies me on a regular basis.
You know what? I think this does justify murder. Let's get him.
Okay, so Questscaping has confirmed that the God Wars Dungeon 3 boss is going to be Shadow Colossus Guildmaster Tony.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, excellent. I love that.
And this question was sent in by probably writing. And yeah, you know, that could be whatever happens to whoever gets sucked into the Codex. And it would open up a lot of discussions going forward on this. Lots of learning, I think. But, you know, I think that what David has suggested is a fun route to go. So we should probably just go with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, plus it could be a skilling boss that incorporates archaeology. How fun would that be?
Yeah, and, I mean, I don't think I don't think he can get Shadow Animud like us, because we have the special bits inside us from Gothics and potentially Sliske as well that are protecting us.
Don't say that you have the special bits of Gothics and stuff.
Oh, no. He sure does.
I gotta go now, but that's quite a way to end.
What a note to end on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, David.
Enjoy that mental image.
Bye. Good to meet you, Questscaping. I thought you were amazing and really insightful, and I was really glad
to
talk to you.
You too.
Bye.
David's going off to dinner, but we're going to continue here. Of course, we got patch notes coming up next. We got a good number of them this week. Starting off, the instructions given in the Lord of Vampirium quest journal upon retrieving the pendant from the icing graveyard have been clarified. I don't remember what those are, but you know, anytime we're talking about quests in the icing, I get interested in. So I'm very pleased about this. Sarah no longer vanishes after entering the cave during the Firemaker's curse, and the fade-out transition that plays while viewing Xenia's memory during Nomad's Elegy no longer loops infinitely after pressing continue. So there's two little patch notes there related to different quests that are out and about with that. You definitely don't want to be stuck in one of those cutscene loops with that. And the music track on the Wings of Air is no longer erroneously unlocked when completing an agility course during Stolen Hearts. It's a bit of an odd one, but all right.
Yeah.
In other patch notes this week, the Halloween event icon has been removed from the world map, and the Menaphite gift rewards from the Pyramid Plunder minigame are now stackable for anyone who does Pyramid Plunder. The Advent calendar will no longer appear during the tutorial, and the Advent calendar banner in Treasure Hunter now correctly links to the Advent calendar interface. Tireless Blood Essence can no longer be used to gain extra adrenaline while an adrenaline potion cooldown is active. And this is something that we really don't talk about that much, is the Blood Essence, because this is what became of the sigils. Believe it or not, after the River of Blood quest. And this was a way of boosting adrenaline. And I guess this is just one of the edge cases that was kind of left off when they brought in all those changes to the adrenaline potions a month or so ago, or whenever that was. It could have been 6 months ago, but you know, in this day and age, a month feels like 6 months, right?
So that's how it is.
Premier Club outfits are now correctly recolored after being applied. The timer will now show the correct time remaining when crafting multiple headless arrows while in dungeoneering. Fixed a bug where only 10 bolas could be fletched at one time instead of 60. And for those unaware, this goes all the way back to the Legends quest.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
Ooh.
You know,
classic days, eh?
Yeah. Well, not RS classic, but definitely classic in terms of vintage. Doing the Legends quest was actually what pushed me into questing, and this was all because I got a hard treasure trail that needed to go into that area.
Ah, I do think it did exist in RuneScape Classic. I think it was the last quest that was released.
It definitely did. It definitely did. It's one of the big iconic quests out there. The augmented hatchet's sheath straps have been removed to keep it in line with other hatchet models. And this is your daily reminder that woodcutting at the high end needs some TLC to make it so that we're not grinding elders until our eyeballs fall out.
Yes, please.
Infinity set items, excluding tops, will now require at least 55 magic and 50 defense to equip. And having the headbutt mining animation equipped no longer increases the time required to mine rocky debris inside dungeoneering skill rooms, because you know those dungeoneering teams are all about efficiency.
It's taking you too long. It's taking you too long. Get the stupid headbutt animation.
Overran by 2 ticks.
And then
we're gonna end it. Come on, man. We're ending it right now.
And then we got a real fun one this week. Players can no longer try to kill Death. And, you know, I'd imagine many people wanted to try to kill him after this week. And you got a nice
little... Yeah, it's a real shame that wasn't this week instead of last week.
Yeah.
Take a bit of revenge.
And, you know, he's sitting there on the table. You hit him. You do one life point of damage to him and he disappears.
Who knew he was that easy to kill?
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh.
Just chase him away.
And the caption on it is it is time for revenge, my fellow hardcore Iron Men.
Turning the tables.
Indeed. All right. We're going to move on to questions right now, the remainder of the questions. But before we do that, I'll just thank our wonderful Patreon supporters for making this episode and a lot of what we do here at RSBNB possible, including our monthly bit that we put out last week on PVM death costs. Definitely give that one a listen to. You know, if you're going to subscribe for anything, that in itself is worth it, because we go through everything. We talk about the argument that the high-end PVMers make. We make talk about the economic argument for people up and coming. And, you know, we had an honest discussion about whether or not death costs are too high in PVM, and whether PVMers are right in saying that, you know, death costs are really prohibitive. And the answer is both yes and no to that, but I'm not going to tell you why that is, because you have to listen for that one, and it's a really fun discussion. But you can find all that and more at patreon.com/RSBNB. And this week for that episode and so much more, I'd like to thank Alvaro L, Andrew C, Brock H, Cameron, Christian S, Cook Me Plunks, Diana, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, Jade W, Jason W, or Jason S, sorry, Joe M, John P, Keski, Kyle, Lucky Ducky, Nora, Rastafa, Ricky A, Samantha R, Soup Finder, Staubeve, The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V, and Zant. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly does mean the world to us, all of us here. And thank you for your support. If you want to get involved with this, just head over to patreon.com/RSBNB. Support the podcast for as little as $1 a month. You get everything that we've talked about thus far. But if you want to go one step further, we also have a VIP tier at $3 a month where you get special stereo editions of the podcast in addition to everything else. And for $5 a month, you get the insider tier, which gives you a shout out each and every week and exclusive access to the outtakes that we use to make the clip show at the end of the year, in addition to everything else. And it's worth noting as well that the $3 tier does also include a Discord rank as well in the RSBNB Discord. So if this is at all interesting to you, patreon.com/RSBNB. Or you can just move us on to where we're going in the future. Of course, right now we got the monthly bit, the round table, which will be happening next weekend, a special flying-themed round table. Inside RSBNB Update this month, we have Joe, one of our contributors, a fun little interview with him, as well as Movie Night, which was last weekend. But moving forward, we also have the prospect of RSBNB merchandise at $200 a month. And, you know, Tanis and I, this was Tanis's idea, this is to subject ourselves to some pain. Should we ever hit that $500 a month tier, we will undertake the Hot Ones Challenge, where we subject our taste buds to a range of spicy wings that, as you said last week, start at the low end of jalapeno.
Yeah, you got the free healthcare and stuff, right, Shane? Can you get me? Can you send me an EpiPen just in case? You know, that's just expensive over here, and you know, just saying.
I don't think EpiPens are used for that, but there you go.
Give them money, make them suffer. That's how it works.
Yeah, that is how it works, unfortunately, in this day and age. So thank you so much, everybody. Patreon.com/RSBNB. All right, so we have already tackled the question about Guildmaster Tony from Probably Writing, so thank you for sending that one in. But moving on to questions from Miss Alaska, if Shadow Anima can be transferred to a soul manually, like with the Adventurer, would it be possible to remove it too? And does it need to be transferred elsewhere at first? What are your thoughts?
This is an interesting. So I think I want to cross-reference some dialogue from the Blackstone Dragon.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So one second. Let me just cross-reference.
Yeah. And
so, because I was doing the Elite Dungeons recently, and it's got some interesting stuff about being made from the shadow.
And you know, I think one of the things that we need to answer throughout all of this is that, is Shadow Anima really the poison that they have said? Or is this something that is just some kind of alternate dimensional thing that appears poisonous, but to those from the Shadow Realm is 100% normal?
Yeah, I have two things to say about that. First of all, there's the Blackstone Dragon dialogue here about potentially removing. So, to quote, during the fight, she says, "The fathers took a part of the shadow and birthed me. That part of myself fills me with anguish. Every living thing contains a darkness, but I am made from it. If I destroy you, who overcame Shadow's grip, I could be free of it myself." So what it's referring to here is that you've just destroyed the Daltak black hands that have come up, grasping around the Blackstone Dragon. Mm-hmm. And the Blackstone Dragon is wondering how you just did that, and wondering if, could this be done to her? Mm-hmm. Because this, while Shadow Anima may potentially be normal to some beings, it's definitely not normal to the Blackstone Dragon, because that's something that's made from dragonkin, from dinosaur, and neither of those are naturally shadow beings, unlike, say, something like the Majorat, or even potentially Zaros, with how he was able to access the chamber we were in.
Right.
On another note, I want to talk about, let me remember. So, talking about transferring Shadow Anima, potentially. There was an interesting thing in the fight that I don't think has come up so far in the podcast. A point in the fight where you can actually use the Shadow Anima against Raksha. I think I also heard somewhere, I'm not sure from who, but it sounds that this is very similar to what happened in Sliske's endgame with the World Guardian Unleashed. You suddenly, out of nowhere, had infinite adrenaline and could just pile all the damage onto Sliske that you can manage.
And we're thinking that was Shadow Anima base too, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Something that you exclusively have as the World Guardian, and something that, presumably uses the damaging power of Shadow Anima. But it's interesting to note that Shadow Anima damages you when Raksha uses it, and it damages Raksha when you use it. So neither of us, we may have it in it, I guess because we're not natively Shadow Anima.
That would be my guess as well.
It does still damage us. Mm-hmm.
And whether or not, and let's circle back to the question, would it be possible to remove that from us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think because we are not entirely Shadow Anima, or not fundamentally shadow anima, like some beings are from creation, perhaps that would be the case. Perhaps, yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think there's any real examples so far of something removing shadow anima from themselves. There's definitely been cases of absorbing it, taking some in, using it. But
yeah, and
so
in the cases
of using it up in the process,
right? And in the cases that we've seen, they've all been transferred by tier two gods or so. You know, gothics or higher.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could store it somewhere else aside from it just being a native area in the shadow anima, or native to the shadow.
I have one other example. So this is very high level archaeology spoilers from the Orphan Mysteries. From the Mysterious City mystery, you actually have a moment where you restore the miniature Moksha device in the Zolo City,
yep.
And all of a sudden some shadow energy just rushes into you, and you go to the monolith, and this increases your monolith power. So you actually absorb shadow energy from this Moksha device, which I guess is... It's designed to transfer souls, and I guess in this case it transfers some shadow anima.
Okay, so there's your method of transferal then, the Moksha mm-hmm. device. And the question is, why would that increase the monolith power, an elder artifact?
Well, we've already discussed that the monolith has something to do with shadow anima right now.
Yeah.
That Raksha was able to come out of it powered by shadow as it is. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my theory...
I also want to say that...
Go ahead.
Yeah?
My theory on the Codex is that I think the Codex is left over from the previous revision.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you move into the next revision, what's the anima from the previous revision becomes shadow anima.
Mm.
That's my working theory.
Heard interesting ideas about that. I've been talking to Diana in particular. She might bring this up on the next lore podcast. That her theory on shadow anima is that it might actually be left over from the past revision. And it's notable that Varanus is able to exist in the Raksha's chamber, and he may be on heavy life support, but he's not affected by the shadow anima, seemingly. Mm. And likewise, Karapak doesn't seem to have any issues dealing with it.
So what I'm getting here is we really need to get this Lore Diggers episode done for Orthon.
Ah, yes.
Because, I mean, I saw those same things too when I was exploring Zolo early on, and I'm working to get that last mystery done by the time we do that. But it's certainly very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to move on to the next question now. Voice acting has shifted to more select pieces of dialogue in the game rather than full quests or areas. Would you prefer to see fully voice acted quests with less frequency, or having voice acting show up in isolated pieces of dialogue here and there in boss fights more frequently? And I know Tanis' answer to this one.
Oh, boy.
Well, my answer is, like, why not both? Why can't we? I mean... Seriously.
Hmm.
Why is it one or the other?
Money.
They were also talking a not money reason around the time of Sliskay's endgame when they had this 50k word quest, essentially. And to voice act all of that would not only be, it'd be money, but it'd also be, it'd essentially lock in the dialogue to a point where you can't really go back and do edits. Especially on something as big as that.
Whereas now, if you need to make a dialogue change to a quest 2 weeks before it comes out, you just change it. You don't need to get that section revoice acted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what they're doing
with
the new...
It's just old style, man. I mean, there aren't really any... At least, I'm not familiar with games that really do that.
Yeah, that's also what they're doing with the new graphical cutscenes, is cutscenes that can just be changed on a whim if they need to.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, I mean, if they backed that with voice, that'd be fine.
Yeah.
Like, why couldn't you just, you know, I mean, just give me a voice, and if you can't do that, give me access to a third party so I can...
That can read it to you.
Do that
because
myself.
That's the main thing you want, is it for it to be readable. And, you know, I think in the Mod Warden era, we thought interface scaling was a pipe dream, but it's right, here now.
Right.
So I think we're at the point where we can say never.
Yeah, you never know. Well, I mean, I guess if I was going to pick one, then I like the voice acted Quest. I mean, I really do. And it's more consequential. Like, I don't know. It's just better to play that kind of a Quest. That's when I like got into Quest, and then I kind of, you know, got hooked on it for a little while. Not so much now, but it was from like that era that, you know, started with, gosh, what was it, Piercing Note, and then, oh gosh, I'm not sure where it ended. I don't know if that was the
I think it was
Song of the Depth,
yeah,
that's Stolen Hearts, Rune Mysteries,
something like that. Yeah. And you know, this piggybacks nicely with the next one. With Story and Lore being implemented into RS outside of quests, as we see new quest release counts go lower in number each year, do you think this is a change that could work for the game? Or do you prefer more frequent quest releases like the old days? And, you know, I'm going to copy Tannis's answer here. Why not both?
Yes. Yes, exactly. I think we could have both of these too.
My guess for quests in 2021, I'm going to say 4.
Okay.
Yeah, just so they can one up this year, hey?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
but,
I think that,
but at the same time, I mean, I don't even know if we can count the Valentine's Day bottle quest this year as a quest, or if we should.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But at least this is, you could realistically get both in this regard.
Yeah.
And the reason why is like, I think Mod Warden touched on this in that episode then as well, but adding these Alliance of Lore and adding this stuff in with like boss scene updates, skilling updates, what it really is world building. And so as long as we're in this world building kind of mindset, then that doesn't make it quest or lore in this way. You're going to get both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's important.
Yeah, that definitely, they're blurring the lines of essentially what an interactive bit of story content can be, because it used to be that this was just quests, but now you've got the elite dungeons, you've got archaeology mysteries, you've got all kinds of mini quests which involve all kinds of things. Yeah, you've got boss fights in which you are finding things out, like this intriguing line about Erebus we were about earlier. So really, I think not just concentrating on quests, but diversifying the kind of content they're putting out
is really important. Because, I mean, you look at 2020, it is one of the biggest years for lore in game. Yes, we do have to.
Oh, okay.
Yes, we do. It's one of the biggest years for lore in game. And there's no questions about it with only 3 quests.
That's true.
You have to say that despite that, that is an amazing accomplishment.
Because it was good story.
Yeah.
Like, they finally started to get really good story.
Yeah. Even, I'd say, Clan Questers, we love our quests, as is in the name. But I think it'd be hard to come by a Clan Quester who isn't really excited about the lore that's been happening going.
And we didn't need quests to do it.
So much.
So, I mean, I think quest counts are going to be lower. We're not going to, you know, be up to the dozen a year that we had. I think eventually, in a good year, once things go back to normal, we'll probably hit the sweet spot of 5 to 6, because that's what players want. And I think something that they can do once we move away from this grand epic storyline and move back to the more character driven models, but you backfill in with the lore that comes in. And this is just a very, very good strategy. So I'm pleased. And my answer stands as more of both, and it sounds like a cop out, but
You've got your reasons.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like you say, Tannis, you got to throw away that piece of Barrow's armor that got you through 2005 to when EOC came out. It's not useful anymore. You got to throw that out despite how much you like it, right?
Yep.
So, and this is the same kind of thing here, in that we need to cast aside the old way of thinking and realize that going into 2021 and beyond, that we're going to have to start thinking of things in new and different ways of approaching the problems that the game has, or the way people see the problems of a lack of quests. So I think that we're okay.
And this is one thing that can, it kind of would be a through line to all of the communities in RuneScape. Like, it's good. When the lore is good, when you're building a vibrant, you know, world, that affects everybody. That makes skilling more consequential. It makes, or you're more invested in it because there's some story with it. Same thing. You know, Anachronia is a really good example of how this is done, and I think we've learned some things.
Well,
about
we're lucky it panned
you
out
know?
This way, because remember, it just started as an island of dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think we knew, I mean, that there was more to come. But yeah, I don't think that was the prevailing attitude at the time.
Yeah, and it's like they say, Tannis, you just gotta let the process play out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I that just felt kinda like common sense to me. Like, no, they added a continent. They have layer upon layer that they're gonna put with this. And then you kinda started to see that, and then you start to see like, oh, they're putting story in everything they're doing. You know, that's what made me start questioning if we were heading back. You know, one of the things I was questioning about going back to expansions, because that's what happens in an expansion like that, right? They build a new area of the world. But it turned out, no, they're just...
We're going back to tried and true month to month.
Right, and learning how to do that within, like, building this new area.
Yeah. Also, just side comment, I am getting Google ads now for reusable high-quality cotton swabs for some reason.
What are you trying to tell us, Shane?
I don't know. I don't know. That was on that Reddit tab of the GIF of death.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Let's just leave that for now.
Yeah, let's leave
we?
That and move on. Thank you, Miss Alaska, probably writing for your questions. Very good. Very good questions. If you guys want to send your own in, email them to questions@rsbnb.com or leave them on Twitter @rsbnb. We're going to wrap the show up shortly, but we'll just move on into tech news before we do that. And, you know, some interesting tech news out of that world this week. The Federal Trade Commission in the United States has filed a lawsuit against Facebook for illegal monopolization.
Yeah, this is going to be all sorts of messed up, dude.
Yeah, with they mentioned Facebook's multi-year course of unlawful conduct.
Yeah, so right thing to do.
Hang on,
but
I just want to say
problem.
How massive this is first. 46 states, D.C.
46? So that's okay, yeah.
And Guam.
Okay. Yeah, because I heard 48, yep. So that's – they're discounting D.C. and Guam.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's everyone. It's and the FTC.
Yeah. And when the FTC gets involved, that's something as well to pay attention to, because it explicitly mentions the acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp. And in documents that were tabled this week, apparently Facebook thought Instagram to be a existential threat.
Well, here's where this whole thing gets really interesting, right? So, okay, yeah, they're saying existential threat, but that's not how monopolization law works.
No.
In the U.S. at all. Number one, it's very vague, and it is very, like, wide in the fact that you have to prove, like, it only counts if you can prove it in that harm is done to the customer. So how does that work when the customer isn't paying for the service? Really,
right.
What they're
making
money
like
off
I said,
of is their information.
Right, and so, like I said, this is a time going forward where we need to consider everything in a different way, because, you know, if the person involved is using Facebook or WhatsApp or Instagram, I don't know if you use any of these Questscaping, but if you try and get off any of these, you can't because of the network effect. And because of that, they have everything so intertwined together. And the lawsuit is going to come down to anti-competitive acquisitions, anti-competitive platform conduct as the two main areas that they want to focus on. And, of course, the acquisition side being the WhatsApp and Instagram that we mentioned.
Then again, you know, this might all be smoke and mirrors because guess what we have? A 6-3 court. Do you think they're going to impose anything against a corporation as big as Facebook like this? No. This might be just to cement that, make sure there's no changes, reinterpretations in the future.
So they just go, hey, look, we done
something. Yeah.
Well, the thing that, you know, I think you guys are missing on this is that despite the fact, like you said, it's a 6-3 court, these judges still have a duty to go out there, look at the case from a legal perspective, and then adjudicate on it based on that. And just like the Google case, this is going to take years to work its way through the system. So we also have to keep that in mind, too, that there's lots of evidence to be heard on this, and not just from Facebook, but from others as well. And, you know, one thing I think that many people aren't aware of
is just how much
sway these networks have in determining what people see and what people's perspectives are of the wider world. Mm-hmm. And that can fall under, of course, anti-competitive platform conduct as well.
It should come under national security. They screwed this country up really bad.
Yeah, I think that's a fair discussion as well.
These algorithms have basically just been a cancer on the society that once talked to each other, and now it's impossible.
Oh, yeah, that's like, the number one thing I tell people is that, you know, despite whichever persuasion you might have, your number one goal is to stay objective and consume news and information from both sides and not silo yourself, because these platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and Facebook is the big one, makes it really, really easy to do that. Well, and that's why we did the Social Dilemma's pick of the week last month or so, because it goes directly into this.
Well, and did you see the recent poll where people don't, they don't realize that is aggregated news. They think there's no difference between getting news on Facebook than like a New York Times or Wall Street
Journal.
What
were the margins on that poll?
It was pretty high. It was like a third didn't know.
Okay,
that
that's
it
a
was,
point at which I'd probably start to pay attention to one of those. But, you know, we're going to be keeping our eye on this here because this is a story that's going to go on and on. But I think everybody has experienced this. If you have a Facebook account, if you have an Instagram account, if you've used WhatsApp, and we could look at other platforms as well. And there's just no way for anybody else to make a splash in these
ecosystems. I don't even have a Facebook, and yet I see the influence it has on people, like talking about the aggregated news. I hear, for instance, from my mother-in-law, she just doesn't experience a certain side of the news because it just doesn't end up coming across her.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what they do, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. All right, this next piece of tech news is for you, Tanis. Google is pioneering something called Look to Speak, which aims to help people communicate with their eyes.
And that is really cool.
Yeah. Normally we talk about accessibility on the Apple side, but this one's coming from Google. And the idea behind this is that a group of researchers at Google has been experimenting and has implemented a similar idea of allowing people to use their eyes to choose pre-written phrases on a screen, their phone, and have them speak out.
That's awesome. I wonder if they've worked with Dr. McDonagan from over there at Special Effect?
I don't know.
Because that's kind of something they were doing.
It's 10 years of development. And you'd think that this is something extra. But this is now available for everybody with Android 9 and above.
See?
Oh, wow.
Now, this is the thing that people don't realize. Like, it is incredible the things that you can do with a phone that they – like, there's a lot of accessibility that I don't think would have came to us without phones and, like, the newer – and phones and newer operating systems kind of in general. But, like, that's what took things that used to cost several thousand dollars and made it free for everybody because – I don't really know why.
Accessibility doesn't just have to be a specialism.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you look at this, and this is something out of science fiction, because you remember in the 1990s, Stephen Hawking had a computer that he would use the muscle movement he had left in his cheek in order to choose the words that his computer would speak. And it was said that in the future you would just be able to, you know, glance at something and have that be what your computer would speak. But now,
here we are.
A phone that you can hold in your hand lets you do this without any physical movement whatsoever.
Yeah.
Basically, everyone's got access to it. I'm also looking at this article, and there was something that struck me in particular. It says all of the data is private and never leaves the phone. That's often one of my hesitancies when working with, say, speech-to-text apps.
Right.
Because that's always been something analyzed for.
That's always been something that Apple has been good at, saying we do this all on device. And it wasn't until the last couple of years or so Google started saying, hey, we're now also doing this all on device as well. So that's good, because when you're using that to speak, you don't want to have a conversation with somebody that is going to be uploaded to the internet. I mean, sure, we trust Google. I trust Google. But you probably don't want to, you know, put all those conversations up there. And
suddenly get targeted ads for it.
Yeah, and it's just really amazing to watch this and see the way it works. Mm. So, 100% free. In what world would we have thought in 2020, Tanis, you going back to 1990s or whenever you started using your text-to-speech software, in what world did you ever think that this software would be ubiquitous and included with every operating system?
I never would have thought. I mean, think about that. Like, if it is on every phone, if it is like an accessibility feature, think about the people that like you could, if you had a stroke or something, you can still communicate. Like a lot of emergencies, anything like that, you couldn't speak, but you could still move your eyes. Like,
and the key is that you do need to train it beforehand. So you can't just turn it on and use it. It needs to be trained to the way that your eyes work, and you need to practice with it as well. So it's not something you can just pick up. It's something that you need to work on. But it's all available on Android.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Amazing low barrier to entry on this. And
just really one more thing for our tricorders, man.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, we also got to have the auditory experience as well. This week, Apple has launched AirPods Max starting at $549 US, $779 Canadian. And, you know, people are going to say that these are just overpriced Apple headphones. And, you know, you could make that argument. You really could. But these headphones also have sensors built into them to enable positional 3D surround sound. So if you're watching a movie on your iPad, you can turn your head, and the perspective of where that sound is coming from will change as you turn your head and rotate it around. It's also got a series of microphones to enable noise reduction, which, you know, you can get fairly cheap noise reducing headphones. I have a pair myself somewhere. But this is Apple's own perspective on doing this. The headphones also have a built-in chip that handles the audio performance. So once again, this is Apple using its own own design chips in their products. They're calling it the H1 chip, and the whole idea behind this is to use, as they say, computational audio to create the optimal listening experience for your environment. And, you know, they're 100% wireless if you want them to be, but you can also connect up a lightning connector to them and use them with a 3.5 millimeter connector if you really want to. And, you know, people really are seeing these as kind of, you know, just a quick little product that Apple unveiled. But I think that this is the future in terms of a wearable headphone. Granted, yeah, expensive now, but I think over time, things like this will have their price come down to where they, you know, rival any other pair of expensive headphones that you could get. But
and something that always happens with tech introductions like these is the competitors and the knockoffs start coming in, so they start becoming more common. Suddenly, tech like this is just ubiquitous.
Yeah, and the thing is that I don't know if anybody will be able to catch up on is that there's 5 sensors on them and 9 microphones. Mm. 8 microphones are used for noise cancellation and 3 for voice pickup.
Okay, so are these supposed to be used in a professional setting?
No.
Way?
No.
Okay, so, man, I've never been so motivated to look at some Beats by Dre. I mean, just saying, man. I mean,
yeah, this is Apple's own version of this. And I realize I'm selling these as something that is revolutionary because I think that they are not going to be a dud. And I think they're going to change the way we see wearable headphones. But at the time, you're entirely right that, you know, this is a product that, you know, you're really only going to buy if you have that huge amount of disposable money. And, you know, apparently lots of people do because they're already sold out and shipping into January and March in some cases.
That's nuts. I mean, I figured it was high because, like, you sent me this article and I was like, I never did find the price. I'm like, ooh, when it don't tell you the price, you know it's bad. And so, but I thought bad would be like maybe $3.99 or something. I never thought it would be $5.99. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, hey, the point is not that these are headphones and that we're going to poo-poo them like some other tech commentators will do. The point that I want to bring forward to everybody is that this is the beginning of another sea change in what we see as headphones and wearable computing, because that's what it is, because it has full Siri integration as well with it.
Well, I could see this as like part, like, can you imagine incorporating this with in VR?
Yep.
Now we're talking immersion.
Exactly.
Now, you know, I mean,
exactly.
You know, because, like, I don't know, maybe I didn't think about it because I'm not really a big movie person, you know. But, man, could you imagine VR? Like, oh.
Yep.
Oh.
That's quite something, yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly where you go with this. That's exactly where you go with this. And I'd imagine they're fairly accessible, too. I did see a page on accessibility with this, how they can be used, but I'm not seeing that here. But, you know, as with anything, Apple has wonderful accessibility, as we know.
Yep. So. Cannot knock them on that.
Nope. And, you know, I actually tested it, Tanis. We actually do have tap the back of our iPhone 8 Plus, and you can actually program that as a button if you wanted to.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know what you'd program yours for, but there's an option.
Yeah. Well, I have my voiceover on the home, but I have like voiceover and magnifier both on my home.
Right. So if you wanted to, you could change one of them out, but it's a topic for a different show.
That's cool. Yeah.
Just a reminder that starting on the 15th, we have our smithing skill of the month that runs from the 15th to the 25th. So if you're listening to this before the 15th, you can sign up at rsbnb.com/skotm for taking some Christmas smithing. But, you know, before that, next week we will be engaging in recording the 2020 clip show. I can't believe we're already approaching the last week of production for 2020, Tanis.
This is the last week of production?
Next week is, yeah.
Oh,
Yeah.
Wow, it was fast, man. Everything has just went really, really fast.
Because, you know...
Well, I mean, it hasn't, but, like, the last 2 weeks have...
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
Yeah. So if you want to help us out with that, if you want to send clips for the clip show, visit update.rsbnb.com/clips. Send us your clips of the year. You know, it could be something crazy or hilarious or just absurd that happened this year. And, you know, if you also have a profound, serious moment, your favorite nibble or bit as well that you want to extract from the episode, if you think that should be a clip, you can send those in as well. We just need the episode number, the time, maybe a description of the clip and your name if you want credit. But update.rsbnb.com/clips. Alrighty. Tanis, start us off with achievables.
All right. Well, this week we have the Lion with 120 magic on December 9th. Then we have Vanek with 99 archaeology on the 9th. We have Zerdones with 99 dungeoneering on December 9th. And Bolter. 99. I thought that said boiler. It's Bolter. 99 with 120 archaeology on December 8th. Then we have Mind with 99 archaeology on December 8th. And Omega with 200 M magic on December 8th. Nice job.
Nicely done. Moving on to the 7th. We have Acronia with 99 thieving and woodcutting. Chief Snake with 99 magic and oldie. Going back many years, that's Brad, one of the former co-hosts of this podcast, got 99 magic on December 7th. Harlot Man with 99 prayer, also on the 7th. Hound Ears with 99 strength. Thieves with 120 divination on the 7th. And Zerdones also got 99 invention on the 7th.
Okay. So, Love Natural got 120 archaeology, December 5th. Barty Pants, Barty_Pants, 99 cooking on December the 5th as well. We have Duramax, who got both 99 construction and 99 fire making on December the 3rd. We have Evil Fan with 120 invention, December the 3rd. Jammy_Jenny with 99 mining on December the 3rd. And Nithereos with 99 ranged on December the 3rd.
Nicely done, everyone. Nice achievements as we start to round out the year. And, you know, we only have a few more picks of the week left, so we're going to give that to our guest here, Questcaping. So what do you have for pick of the week?
Hello. So I have a game I would like to recommend. It's a game called NeoCab. It's a visual novel game, and there are several reasons why I like it. It's got the very tech-focused aspect of the story. So this is one of these sci-fi but near-future settings. It's one of the sort of things that takes tech we have today and just evolves it very slightly further and goes through some of the social consequences it could have. So, for instance, the main thing here, you play as a cab driver, say, like Uber. They've got a ride-sharing system that operates very much like that. And they've just come to this new city in which driven cars, driven by humans, have almost entirely been eliminated and replaced with self-driving cars. And something that you've got as an overwhelming, looming concern in the story is the passage of a new law which will outlaw humans driving cars outright. And while that's the main focus of the story, I think there's also several other aspects it goes into, all about how tech influences people's lives. For example, there's a lot about how the manipulation of emotions through technology works.
That's very true.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hmm. That's quite a prominent concern. And stuff like, there's a character, for instance, who works in risk assessment software, and becomes quite a paranoid person coming out of that. Yeah. So you, as this driver, are shuttling a whole bunch of people around the town, and a lot of those naturally are either in tech or work with tech. Like this actor who acts in virtual reality plays that people essentially purchase and then experience, like, state of the acting industry in this city. Yeah. Another level on which I like it on is these characters. You only get to know snippets of them, but it's, have you ever had the experience of just chatting to someone like on a relatively light scale, but really enjoying the little insight you get into their lives?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
if you don't meet them again afterwards, I think this game is that, but yeah. Yeah, just that encapsulating that experience of getting to know people through these very short encounters.
Yeah, and from what
Another
you said, it sounds
like
it'd be a very interesting perspective on society today, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Another thing, it really makes use of the sort of 80s synth soundtrack and aesthetic, sort of neon purple and whatnot. And I'm a person who is a sucker for that, so you've got that going on in the background of what is this kind of really, really richly textured game. And yeah, I think the soundtrack for it has just become my go-to soundtrack for doing just about anything that needs focus. So yeah, a lot of levels on which I like it, and quite happy to recommend it.
All right, and it looks like there's also a Mac version as well, available on Steam, of course. So give that a check out, NeoCab. Tanis, what have you been up to this week?
Give you a hint. It's on Anachronia.
Uh-huh. Orthon?
You know. Yeah, I'm back to the archaeology grind. I just can't. I don't know. Can't stop, won't stop. Yeah. Especially now that I have my mobile back on my phone, because it was like broken for a long time, because I couldn't figure out how to turn the cookies off.
Oh, interesting. All right.
And it would not go. I mean, it was fine on my iPad, but I must have updated my, I don't know what happened, but anyway, finally figured that out. So we're back in mobile now. So it's on.
All right. Well, I can tell a story on that front. Would you like me to?
Yeah, let's hear it.
So I've completed this adventure now, almost completed. I just have to restore the artifacts. I'm very close to 117 archaeology, and I, you know, at 116 I got the few artifacts from that spot and brought them to the collector. Then I went back to the Red Rum 3 spot, which is a very nice spot at 115. It has all three, first of the three you need for Red Rum 3. But it also happens to be the archaeology spot where you get the spear tip. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got one of those spears.
Yeah, wow. That's awesome.
So that was fun. I wasn't expecting that. I actually forgot that was part of archaeology at that point. So that was that was really fun to get that. And I think I'm probably going to keep the spear at this point.
I was going to say, you're going to forge it?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Right on.
Because that'll be, you know, that's basically, after the Masterwork trims, that's a free tier 92 weapon, right?
It's I know. I totally would make it. Like, just for the mere fact that that's one of the weapons that I could. So, yeah, for sure.
Like, I was talking with David, and I said, you know, should I make this or should I not? And he said, you know, unless you're fighting Araxer or doing Slayer, this is, you know, going to be the melee weapon that would be good to use, because, you know, it's tier 92. It's going to do the same damage as everything else. And, you know, if you ever wanted to get a special or something else, you can do that with Essence of Finality now. So I will probably wind up making it a tier 92. But, you know, after I get 117, the task is actually going to be to make it into the actual Spear of Annihilation. So that was a nice little fun surprise on the road to 117. But I've started Ironmanning it myself, and as of this point,
ouch.
No, it's fine. As of this point, I've gathered about 500 UBS clay and 920 odd third age iron. And I have to gather, you ready for this? 1600 animal furs.
Woo!
So I don't know if I'm going to do the animal fur one, because that one's a bit far away from a deposit box. And I don't know if it's worth putting
Iron Man with the occasional cheat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But surprisingly, I had enough vulcanized rubber and fossilized bone as well sitting. I don't know where all that came from, but it's there. But
for a drum three.
Yeah. Still very much enjoying archaeology with that. So such a fun skill. But, you know, just occasional herb runs also thrown in on that. But I get all the rare drops, it seems.
Yeah.
How about
getting
you?
All the richer.
How about you, Questcaping?
Oh, as for myself, I've been doing the various Rapture attempts. That's taken up a lot of my week. I've also been preparing a couple of things on the Clan's Quest side of things. So, for instance, we've got the Clan Quest Advent Calendar going on all through this month up to Christmas Day. And that's had several things that we've put out as content just to try and encourage people to donate to Direct Relief, which is the charity we're fundraising.
Yeah, I think that was
a good
choice. And
there's been a lot of streaming going on. Yeah. Yeah, I did a little looking into it in the process of writing up the content for our Advent Calendar, and I found that it's a really good charity in how they use their money efficiently. It's got a really good rating from Charity Navigator and just absolute efficiency in putting the money to where it needs to go rather than into people's salaries or whatever. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of content going on with that. There's been a lot of streams, for instance. We did a stream of Violet is Blue. We're going to be streaming Violet is Blue 2 on Monday. And also, I did a lot of my Rapture attempts on stream. So the Clan Quest Twitch, twitch.tv/ClanQuest. If you want to see me dying, that's where to go.
And
I've also been...
Go ahead.
Yeah. Organizing a bunch of minigame events. Now, these are a thing that happen with Clan Quest twice weekly, no matter what. So 9 p.m. game time on a Saturday and 4 p.m. game time on a Sunday. Except this month, they're actually integrated into the Pink Skirts event and being put on the in-game calendar, being announced in the official news posts and whatnot. So yeah, so that's quite exciting. And so the 12th of December, this Saturday, and also my birthday, there's a Barbarian Assault going on at 9 p.m. game time. And yeah, that looks to have quite the attendance after it got announced in the game news post. I'm quite pleased about that. Quite excited.
Well, happy incoming birthday, too. I was not aware of that. And, you know, I'll just say to everybody else, you want to take part in any of these, you want to take part in the Advent Calendar, clanquest.org, or guest in the clan chat. We got many, many opportunities, areas where you can take part. But, you know, when it comes to events, Questcaping is our front person for that. So thank you so much for organizing all these events. It's really, really nice to see.
Thank you. I always like to keep something going on.
Yeah, and I'm very, very thankful that you've taken up that mantle. So that's good. Well, I believe that's it, Tanis. I believe we have come to the conclusion of another one of these episodes where you and I are just along for the ride.
Yep.
So we'll be back next week, of course, to discuss Violet is Blue 2. I'm auctioning off slots amongst the update producers because everybody wants to be on that one. we're also going to be recording the last Lore Diggers episode of the year that will come out on Christmas Eve, barring anything going wrong. And, of course, the clip show. So we got a lot of fun stuff coming up in the next week. But we're not taking a break this year. So if you want to subscribe to us, make sure you get all your podcasts delivered automatically to you. Visit update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, and even YouTube, youtube.com/rsbnb. And we'll see you guys next week for another episode of RSBNB Update. Remember, of course, to check out the show notes at update.rsbnb.com. And if you want a guesting game, we're at Friends Chat Bits Bites. See you next week for another episode, everyone. Take care.
See ya.
Thank you. Bye-bye.